Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Thank you, Pete. Welcome back. Grant and Danny, 106.7 The Fan. It is 1 o'clock, and that means it's time for the big one. And today we're going to rank the five best tight ends in the NFL. We're doing that because yesterday was payday in the National Football League at that position. Back-to-back contracts done for George Kittle and Travis Kelce. Real quick, I wanted to ask you. I was just texting with a buddy of mine about this. So Damian Lillard's got to be the MVP of the bubble, I would think. He had a 51-point game, a 61-point game, and then last night a 42-point game. And if you watched it, it was incredible TV. The Blazers had to win to get into the playoffs. If they didn't, the Suns would have gotten in. And it came down at the last second to a shot off the rim from Caris LeVert of the Nets to knock the Blazers out of the playoffs. And the shot was no good, so the Blazers move on. 134-133 final. But I think he's your bubble MVP, but yet, my buddy thinks it's Devin Booker who averaged 31 points and 6 assists. I got another person here saying they thought it was T.J. Warren who was awesome. I think he was really good. But I don't know how anyone watching all those games wouldn't just say it's Damian Lillard. Everyone else was competing for second place.
Yeah, T.J. Warren was getting buckets. He was kind of the early story. And then here comes Lillard, like waves crashing on the shore with a couple 60-point games and some 50s. And, you know, I think he had a 16-assist game in there. Devin Booker was transcendent for an 8-0. Phoenix Suns team. They didn't even make the little play-in game thing that's going to happen, which is a bummer, but would have been a lot of fun to see them. They were 8-0 in the bubble, so good for Phoenix for figuring out a team to watch certainly next year. But this is the Damian Lillard show. Anything else is a hipster take. He was incredible. He was absolutely, not that these other guys weren't, but this doesn't happen. These kinds of runs are done by the Jordans of the world. These are done. This is LeBron James in the finals single-handedly against Golden State a couple years ago when everybody was injured except for him. Those are the kinds of totals he was putting up. It was absurd.
All right, let's rank the best tight ends in the NFL. And because I think that the intrigue is actually probably down toward the bottom of our list, we can go 1 to 5 here. I'm going to start it with Kittle as my number one, and we'll see if you agree. But, I mean, this is a guy in 2018 that averaged over 15 yards per catch in 88 receptions. At that position, that does not really happen. He's running deeper routes. Yes, yards per target, about 10.1, than some tight ends do. But also, it's yards after the catch. It's running away from people. You've seen some of the great highlights of him running through tackles and shoving guys to the ground. I mean, you just don't bring him down by yourself. Back-to-back 1,000-yard seasons. He's been in the league for 3 years. He went 88 for 1,377 in his second year, and then last year went 85 for 1053. Like, came all the way back to being a 1,000-yard receiver with 5 touchdowns. He missed 2 games. He would have caught, I don't know, 95. It's not out of the realm of possibility. 100 balls for probably 1,300 yards for the second straight year. So I'll go Kittle number one.
The best receiver is Travis Kelce. The best tight end is George Kittle. George Kittle's complete. Echo everything you said. He's probably 90-some percent of what Kelce is as a receiver. Kelce, 97 catches, 1,230 yards, and 5 touchdowns, which, by the way, was fluky. Should have been twice that, probably. Just, you know, bad luck.
Same number of touchdowns as Kittle, by the way.
Yeah, touchdowns are fluky. But he plays in a better offense. We know about how dynamic they are. George Kittle does most of what Kelce does in the receiving game and is an absolutely dominant blocker. George Kittle blocks like Brian Kozlowski. He blocks like a left tackle. He blocks like a 280-pound dude with a neck roll that runs a 5.9 40, and yet he is a matchup nightmare. That's what makes that offense go. He is the weapon to me. I mean, this the thing that I've always fallen in love with about athletic power forwards in the NBA is the temptation of, I'll put a smaller guy on you. I'll work your butt down there in the post. I'll put a bigger guy on you. I'll go right around you. That matchup versatility where you cannot cover them one-on-one, Kittle has that. And if you want to you want to put a quarterback on him, that guy's going to get knocked into the 10th row in terms of blocking. He is an animal in that regard. Number one overall perfect tight end in today's NFL.
So you're going Kelce second then, it sounds like.
Yes, I am.
And I will as well, and I'll just make the quick case for Kelce. I mean, look, the numbers don't lie. Look at the receptions, 85, 83, 103, 97 the last 4 years. No other tight end in the league has anything like that on the ledger. Yardage last 4 years, 11, 25, 10, 38, 13, 36, 12, 29. He's a good blocker. He's not on the Kittle level. I don't know that anybody in the league is not named Gronk, who's coming back, and we don't know how much he's got left as a receiver now.
Right.
But Kelce, who got paid after Kittle, not quite as much as Kittle, is also very special. So those are the top two guys. So this is where the list opens up a little bit. I'll be honest, I don't think there should be much debate at number three. I think the guy I'm about to name is the unquestioned third best tight end in football, but maybe you've got another idea, and I'd be willing to listen to that. I've got Zach Ertz of the Eagles third.
Yep.
The former second-round pick out of Stanford. Are we in lockstep there?
100%. He's great. He's underrated, too, because he's not as sexy as the other guys, but a unbelievably consistent player, great route runner. He's not faster than those other players, not as explosive, but he is a clinician working those intermediate and short routes. He's great.
Big difference for him and where I put him, probably a good little gap behind these guys. A lot of what he runs is way closer to the line of scrimmage. Those other guys are way further downfield on a lot of their targets and are in the what I would consider, as you said, the intermediate range, or sometimes kind of digging things out in 14, 15 yards. You don't see as much of that from Ertz. Doesn't mean he doesn't do it, but his yard per target, about 6.8. You know, and that's something they've been keeping since 1992. Last year, for the average of his career, around 7.5. The Kittle and Kelce types, they're closer to about 10. That doesn't take anything away from him. It just means he's used a little differently. And it's why he averages 10 yards per reception instead of the 12 to 15 that those other guys do. But he caught 116 balls in 2018. I'm pretty sure 93 of them were against Washington. But 116 balls 2 seasons ago, 88 last year. He's caught 74 or more in now 5 straight seasons. And he's been in the league, believe it or not, already for 7 years. So Ertz, for me, is number three. This is the first time I had a chance to get creative on my list at number four. I went with Darren Waller of the Raiders. Strictly pass catching, he's basically what Jordan Reed was before Jordan Reed wasn't anymore. People completely hibernate on this guy. So he last year played 16 games. He was in the league in 15 with the Ravens, was out of the league in 2017. Has had terrible issues with addiction and drinking and alcoholism, and he's well documented all of his problems, and he's come back on the other side and lives a straight-edge lifestyle now, and he's easy to root for that reason. But last year, his second year with the Raiders, he went from 6 catches, having played, a couple of times basically the season before, to a 90-catch, 1,100-yard weapon. I mean, he's just an uncoverable tweener. He's basically a big wide receiver. He's not even really a tight end. He's 6'6", 255. He can block. He can get in your way. He's actually from Landover, Maryland, by the way, went to Georgia Tech. But Darren Waller, I think, is just a guy there aren't many of in this league right now. So I put him fourth.
I don't know what Rob Gronkowski I'm getting. I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. So if he was, if I didn't have mystery, he would be right here for me. But I could have gone Waller. The guy that I'm going to go with is a lot less sexy than Waller. I agree with you that Waller's the next best receiver on that list. I got Austin Hooper as a guy that, again, people overlook and they don't really care. Kind of in that Zach Ertz mold, the complete tight end, right? Pretty good blocker, I feel like. Not an explosive receiver, is not getting over the top on people, is not going to run away from everybody, but is the third down security blanket. In an offense that had a lot of mouths to feed, managed about 800 yards and 6 touchdowns on 75 receptions, and you don't know what's coming when he's on the football field. He was the class of this free agent group, which doesn't mean much because it wasn't a great tight end group, but I've always liked Hooper as a kind of, again, that unsexy but complete overall package tight end. So give me him narrowly over Waller and an unknown over Gronkowski at number four.
Number five for me, I kind of went back and forth, a few different options, thought about throwing Gronk in. I'm going to go Hooper. The numbers just say it's an easy case to make. I don't think Hooper's a particularly good blocker, though. In fact, I think at times it's a little bit of a weakness in that regard. So I am more than willing to move around the board at number five, but I'll throw him on there so I have someone.
I had Waller at five. Just, again, to me, a receiver that sometimes lines up really close to a tackle You know what I mean? Like, that guy is fun to watch as a wideout, making those DeAndre Hopkins sort of sideline catches, big strong hands, getting away from people. He is a lot of fun.
Another day, another homer for Juan Soto. Even when the Mets hit him because they couldn't get him out, the Juan Soto appreciation segment we've kind of stumbled into this week and been doing the last few days. We'll run it back because he's given us another reason to next on Grant and Dan. I know the baseballs are juiced out of control. I get that. Save that part of your analysis and call. I don't care. My goodness, Juan Soto. 460, 460, 430. Another homer yesterday. After the Mets hit him in the butt, by the way. Very clearly, I thought, hit him on purpose. He's beating them one homer after another the entire series. It's a 1-1 count. It's a 1-1 game early. They hit him right in the butt. I mean, nowhere near the strike zone for a guy who's been around the strike zone most of the game. Soto's staring out at the mound. Pretty salty. I was actually surprised as the game went on that the Nats didn't answer the bell there and get one of the Mets, probably because, they'd been warned already, so somebody would have been ejected, but also because the game kind of got out of hand and out of reach, but I thought that would have made it even more easy to pull
compelling,
off, honestly. Yeah. But there will be more games against the Mets, and I'm sure they will hit somebody as a result, which I don't condone, and I don't think is what should happen, but that's what they do in baseball in kind of an eye-for-an-eye world. But I want to read this from our buddy Cheese, who's a big Nats fan who listens. He says, hey, I can't call in to talk about Juan Soto with you, but here are the points I'd like to make. He posts a picture. It looks like of a T-Mobile appearance. You know how the Nats were big on like all those like local T-Mobile things? You and I have done some of those. They send a player out to a T-Mobile store, and they take pictures with fans and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So Cheese met Soto there, and he posted the picture. He said, here are the points I'll make. One, he is the best young baseball player in baseball. Two, he won a World Series. Three, he hits balls very far. Four, he is my best friend. See below. Five, he is very handsome. Also see below.
All true.
That's how the Juan Soto appreciation segment goes, which we've kind of stumbled into over the last couple of days. He's not slowing down, Danny. The quality of his at-bats, which have blown me away since he got to the big leagues initially, have always been incredible and impressive. The power has always been on display. But I think this week, the turning point has been in how far the homers are going and just what they look like to the opposite field as well. It started in the playoffs. A couple of those homers he hit against the Astros were
absurd.
Batting practice, stop what you're doing and talk about what your teammate just did kind of home runs. Not in-game home runs. And he's coming into play today, a .414 average, a .1486 OPS.
Yeah, his average went down yesterday because he went 1-for-3. You know, check his temperature. Must be sick. I mean, the homer he hit off Verlander, 96, upper quadrant of the zone on the inside corner, chest high, and he just calmly drilled it into the upper tank. He's amazing. The homer he hit off of Gerrit Cole, opposite field. That's where a muscle-bound right-handed superstar would go. Just casually did that. He's superhuman at this point. And there are certain people that are put on this earth who can keep the head of the bat in the zone for an incredibly high percentage of their swing. Albert Pujols could do that when he was young, and Juan Soto can do that. And that's why you see these things happening where they're happening. That's why you get opposite field homers that don't have that kind of curveball spin and die 15, 20 feet short. That's why he can pull the ball and keep it fair on a pitch that's that inside, that in tight on him. That's why he can hit it 460-some feet into a concession stand. It's why he can drive the ball to center field off a left-handed curveball where he's slightly off balance 463 feet. It's a gift. God said you. He didn't say that to a lot of people. He said it to him, to Juan Soto. Thank goodness he's here. Thank goodness Juan Soto is here, because imagine what their offense would look like without him at this point. He's incredible, man. He is the consistent weapon. Through eight games, he's got five homers. He's on the league leaderboard despite having played about a third of some of the other guys.
That is what's also hilarious. Is I didn't realize that until just looking it up a couple of minutes ago, right before we did the segment, about the number of games he played, because I knew, well, it's pretty obvious and pretty clear, that he hasn't played much. You know, he had COVID, and then the team didn't play for a full weekend. But I was thinking, just randomly top of my head, like 10 to 12 games, five home runs. Eight games he's played so far. 29 at-bats. So just do this math here for a second. I mean, a normal season, roughly, you know, you can go up or down from here, but it's about 600 at-bats. what would he be doing over 600 at-bats? Now, he won't stay at this pace, but if you're just talking about the pace that he's on right now, I mean, come on. What are we doing here? It's insane.
He's tied for 15th in homers. He's tied for 15th in the league with a number of players who have five. But that's where he is.
You know what the pace would be? Again, it's not a pace that he will sustain. But over 162 games, based on what he's done so far, it would be a 103-homer season.
Has that ever been done?
What? And we haven't mentioned his age, and it probably gets tiring for people to hear people, you know, talking about that he's 21. But it's part of this. I'm sorry, it is. He's 21. Literally. The same age you were when you had your first legal sip of alcohol. That's how old this guy is. If he was 30, he'd still be amazing. If he was Mike Trout and he had this week, it would just be an excellent week for Mike Trout. He's probably the greatest player who's ever lived. Bryce Harper, all due respect, man, has nothing on Juan Soto. Like, they're not even in the same stratosphere as baseball players at this point. I'm sorry. Christian Yelich is in the conversation, not this year, but, like, he's probably the best player in the National League. Juan Soto might be every bit as good as anybody in the NL. Mookie Betts has come over to the National League from the American League, so he'll be in this convo for years. Yelich, I think, is the best player in the league. Cody Bellinger won the MVP award because Yelich got hurt last year. Those are the guys. Juan Soto's in that group. Davey said, I think it was yesterday, it might have been the day before, Juan Soto's going to win an MVP award at some point in his career. No kidding. How many is he going to win?
Yeah,
this
National
guy might
League
win
field.
Three or four. This is a Hall of Famer in our midst that we're talking about. And I know he's 21, but this is the skill. This is the talent. This is what it looks like. Look at the list that he's on based on the games he's played so far.
That's the track. That's the track. I mean, the National League is going to be crowded for years to come with guys like Mookie Betts, who you touched on. Fernando Tatis Jr. is a superstar
in
San Diego.
There.
I mean, he's great. Trevor Story is going to calmly put up absurd numbers in Colorado for a
I'll
minute.
I'll put him in tier two pretty comfortably.
He's great. You see the point. It takes – Ronald Acuna, we haven't even mentioned yet, is a superstar in his own right. But Soto right now, in terms of hitting the baseball, needs to be mentioned – in the first sentence when you're talking about the greats of the game. That's where we are. The best hitters in the game, you need to, in that first sentence, you don't go, there's also Juan Soto. You need to mention Juan Soto in the first sentence when you're talking about who the best hitters are, right? I mean, Trout is obviously right there. Aaron Judge is right there. Mookie Betts is right there. Juan Soto's in that group. He needs to be in that camp, the first few names out of your mouth when you start talking who are the best hitters in baseball overall. And the rest of the game continues to improve as a defensive outfielder and the like.
Guilo says, I find it stunning Harper wanted to be the superstar here and waved his DC flags and bandanas, and I love Juan Soto so much more. Yeah. I mean, first of all, Soto's a better player than Harper. Now, Harper had a season when he won the MVP award, the likes of which hadn't really happened, but he was never this good a hitter. I mean, he's just not. His hit tool and Soto's hit tool are in different neighborhoods. Power, Harper has 80 power, light tower power, just like Juan Soto does, so that's comparable. Home runs in a season, both of these guys could be annual 40 home run types, so that's where there's a comparison. But Harper's got so much more swing and miss. He's got some of the same patience and will draw a lot of walks, but he does not have the batter's eye as Juan Soto. They're probably similar outfielders, although Soto, young and kind of improving, I think will end up being much better defensively than Bryce. That one plays left, one plays right, obviously. Harper's got a stronger arm. But just ask around to people in baseball. Who would you rather have? Come on. It's not really a debate. Oh, by the way, Bryce making $330 million. Juan Soto's still on a deal based on when he was signed originally, coming over from the Dominican, and by the standards of baseball, makes the peanuts you eat while you wait for your burger in the lobby of Five Guys. And I know it's
having...
weird to even comp him to Harper, but that's
but it makes
the
sense.
Point is they let him walk because they had Juan Soto waiting in the wings, and it's taken not even 2 years, and Soto's already surpassed him. As far as I'm
so Harper, to his credit, is having an unbelievable year through 14 games. We're talking about a year. I mean,
well,
he's an
unbelievable
so
player. He's a top 10 talent in the game.
I want to see Soto have the 2015 that Bryce Harper had. I think he's capable of it. I mean, that 330, 42 bombs season that Harper had with no one around him in the lineup doing anything is one of the best offensive seasons we've seen in, you know, recent league history. And I think Soto is capable of doing that. And I wish this was a 162 campaign, because I think this would be the year that it was happening.
What did you just describe Harper's season as so far, by the way?
Really good.
Okay. I thought you said, like, unbelievable or whatever. But whatever you said, right? Which is true. Soto, who's played fewer games and has fewer at-bats, more home runs.
Yep.
Better batting average.
I know.
You know, more everything. Name what it is. OPS, 300 points higher. Like, it's just crazy, man. It's absolutely nuts what this guy's doing. Grant and Danny on the Fan, that is your daily Juan Soto appreciation segment right here on your flagship home for the Nats. Nikki Javala covers Washington's football team for the Post. We've got some things to discuss with her, including the wide receiver position and when they're actually going to get to scrimmage good on good 11-on-11. We'll do that next. Final stretch of Grant and Danny for the day and the week on this Friday. The weekend looms. You can hear the people off in the distance. Yeah, they're ready for the weekend. Ready for some Caps playoff hockey. Couple of Nats games today. Eventually, maybe, just maybe, we'll actually get to see coverage of a real life football practice. Didn't happen again today because of the weather. But Nikki Javala would have been there. Washington Post covers the Washington football team. Nikki, you're going to see football again at some point, right? Or should we be confident about that? I mean, what's going on?
I don't know. I mean, they keep telling me I will, but so far no dice. So I don't know. I hope so. I would like to.
Would be nice.
Fingers crossed.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it would be nice.
And I get it.
Yeah.
I guess they go into the bubble when there's bad weather. You guys aren't allowed in there. And then today the field was still wet, so I guess you will next see them on the 18th. What I worry about, though, is – The season starts in less than a month is their first game. There's never been less done in terms of practices a month out for this football team than right now. That just has to matter. Maybe every team's going through the same thing, but it's crazy to me.
Yeah, I mean, they're allowed a maximum of 14 padded practices. We'll get to see 10 practices now, you know, weather permitting, of course. But there's no preseason games, obviously, no joint training camp practices. The guys that I think would be affected the most are the guys that in normal years are clawing for that last roster spot, and don't have that chance to really show what they can do in game or against live competition in any capacity. They just have their practice time and going against each other. So it's going to be really difficult for, you know, those undrafted guys, those veterans, you know, deep on the depth chart. It's going to be really tough. And I mean, just in general for this team, you still got a pretty young quarterback. You got many new faces on both sides of the ball, and you have a completely new coaching regime and new systems. I mean, the challenge is probably greater than ever this year.
Nikki, for you, as you're covering this group, and whenever you are allowed some access to see some practice or football or otherwise, as they're getting ready for the season, what is the headline? What's the biggest story right now with the Washington football team for you?
On the field or off the field?
Wherever you want to take it.
I mean, off the field, I think it's, you know, the future of the franchise. I mean, who's going to own this team in the long term? To me, I think it always starts with ownership. That was something I dealt with in Denver quite a bit. On the field, I think you always have to look at the quarterback position. It's the most important position, and you can have a tremendous defense. And I think they have the pieces for that. But if you don't have the right quarterback, then it's you're not going to go very far. So I'm looking at, you know, where does Dwayne Haskins stand in his development? Is it really plausible for Alex Smith to actually return and play like Alex Smith and be able, you know, to where does he stand with his injury and his recovery? I mean, that's probably the biggest in my mind. They're the most important pieces to the puzzle.
Nikki Javala of the Washington Post on Grant and Danny. Within the last hour, you were on the Zoom call with Reuben Foster, and I'm sure that takes away a little bit of the personalization of some of the interviews. But we just don't know a lot about him, to be honest with you, his personality, him as a dude. What did you take away and learn from him? The quote that you tweeted out I thought was hysterical. He said something like, "To know Reuben is to love Reuben." That's all I'll say about that. And that was like the end of him talking about what people think of him publicly. But just tell us a little bit about him, because he's an interesting figure in this defense.
Yeah, it was an interesting press conference. You know, it's interesting to hear how uncertain he was still. You know, he admitted he's still trying to gain confidence in his knee. He still thinks about his knee when he's out on the field a lot. I think it was to be expected that he didn't really want to delve too much into his past legal troubles, other than to say that he's learned a lot. And you hope that's the case, and you hope that there aren't more in the future for him. But I thought it was interesting to admit, you know, and really show his vulnerability. I mean, you just don't see that in these guys in general. But yeah, he's a wild card for this team, just given his history. I mean, he could either be, you know, one of the greatest players, for the franchise and really in some ways carry the defense, not to discredit what Chase Young and that defensive line is capable of doing, but he's that kind of player. But you just never know, and physically and off the field, you know, what the future holds for him. But it was an interesting press conference to hear just how he felt and, you know, how much he loves the game and how he still thinks about, you know, that the injury and, you know, whether his career might have ended then. And, yeah, it was interesting.
Nikki Jabala with us here, covers the Washington football team for the Washington Post here on Grant and Danny. Nikki, you mentioned the quarterback previously. I want to go back to that. By all accounts, this offseason has been great for Dwayne Haskins. And I think fans of this team for a long time kind of roll their eyes at that, because we've heard about great offseasons before. Best shape of his life. He hired a private chef. He took up ballet or yoga and is more flexible. And then the production never seems to match. Will the production match this time for Dwayne Haskins? It's critical that it does, as this is a new regime, and they need to figure out if this is the guy going forward.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way of knowing now, and there's certainly even less of a way to know without seeing him take, you know, face any live action between now and the start of the season. You certainly hope so, as you said. You know, you really need him to develop into the guy going forward. If anything, you want to see him take a big leap in year two. That's kind of what you expect from all rookies when they come in, that there's going to be some sort of transition period. It's going to be slow going, but they start to show some improvement by year two. You notice a big leap where they're more comfortable, and yes, they're still making mistakes, but they're productive. They start to understand the game, that it's slowing down for them. You know, they're taking on more of a leadership role for quarterbacks. They, you know, take command of the huddle, and guys follow them. You want to have, you know, the rest of the offense follow his lead. So you certainly hope that's the case. But, yeah, this is the point in the season where everything is sunshine and rainbows. You know, the slate is cleared. Everybody's had, even in a pandemic, everybody has had a really great offseason. Has gotten into training, has lost weight. They're in the best shape of their life. They're smarter than they've ever been in their life. And wouldn't it be great if that were the case for all of us? but, you know, it's going to be so hard to really know what's true and what's fluff and until the actual real game starts, just because there's no lead up this year.
Nikki, there is no lead up, but we're getting the coverage that we need and finding out about the team through the hard work of people like you with these Zoom calls and the weird ways that you're being asked to do your job. Thanks very much for hopping on with us and the insight. We appreciate it.
You bet. Have a good one, guys.
Thanks, Nikki.
Nikki Jabala, check her out in the Washington Post. We're Grant and Danny. As always, we've got this date in Nats history to get to before we get out of here. Also, the best of the rest and some leftovers before the weekend ahead. G&D on the Fan. Danny, you always kind of update us when something weird happens and you don't do anything, but your body just starts aching for some reason and you refer to it as you becoming really old.
Just an old person.
All I've done since 10 a.m. is sit down. Literally, that's what I've done.
That was your sin.
My back is killing me right now.
Uh-huh.
No idea why. Can't explain it. Lower back issue just absolutely
Zoom. Via the Zoom, can you show me the chair you're sitting in? Show me your setup.
I'm on a couch right now.
I can't explain that then. I can't explain that. Because mine, as you've seen, I have just the nubsiest, worst metal chair of sadness. It's like a punishment chair where it's like, you misbehave, go sit in that chair and face the wall. You know, it's that kind of thing. And I've put like a couple accoutrements down here to try to ease the pain. But that's why one of the reasons I got to get up and move around and why I'm late for approximately 15 to 20% of the segments is I can't just sit here and because everything hurts all the time. But yeah, I get it, dude. I get it. I wake up with a mystery soreness every day and I play detective. What did I do? What innocuous thing did I do the day before or maybe 2 days before at this stage that has led to this dramatic discomfort? It's ridiculous. And it makes me appreciate further people like Tom Brady, people like Max Scherzer, who I am very similar in age to. I'm closer to Max Scherzer's age than I am to yours, and it's not even close. How are they still doing these things at such a high level? How are they still doing these things? I'm sore all the time, and I do nothing. I do nothing. I'm going to take my son to ride his bike. He's getting decent at it. He's learning how to ride his bike, and it's a big dad accomplishment. I'm going to have to run alongside him for minutes just to make sure to spot him, right? Something will be cripplingly sore, even if cripplingly is not even a word. Something's going to be so painful in the next 24 to 48 hours that I'll barely be able to move around, and my wife will be cross with me. That's my future.
This date in Nats history, it's August 14th, 2020. You got to go back in time to find yourself a fun August 14th in the past for the Nationals. So how about we go back to 2013, 7 years ago today, a 6-5 win over the Giants, and a great moment from our guy, Denard Span.
Outfield shortening up now with a tying run at second. The pitch. Breaking ball hit in the air to left center field. Span of the run. On the run, way back. He dives. He caught it. He caught it. It's a diving spectacular catch to end the game. Unbelievable. Denard Span has done it again. He saves the night. What a play to end the game. Skidding on the grass, shy of the warning track, sliding on his back, onto the track, and bang, zoom, a curly W's in the books.
When our buddy Vic, JT the Vic, sends those highlights the night before, and so we could check them out if we want to and kind of look at it, right? So I went back and looked up video of that catch. That was an amazing catch. I think that's the second best game-ending catch in Nationals history. What do you think my number one seed is?
Game-ending catch?
Game-ending catch of significance.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Souza?
Souza. Steven Souza.
I got to thank Thommy. He fed me that. I wasn't thinking about that, but yeah, that's a good one.
An unbelievable moment. Yeah, so Souza preserving the no-no was pretty incredible. And then that one's probably number two. That was ridiculous. The jump he got, the route he took, the you really saw Denard Span have to do anything in a hurry, right? Because he was so smooth. That's why they played smooth operator. When he would glide around out there, he took great jumps and great routes. He was a technician. But that one, he was on his horse, and he made an unbelievable play to win the game.
Alex Cintron, the hitting coach for the Astros, who are struggling, suspended 20 games for egging on Ramon Laureano, who he got to fight him or try to fight him in the benches clearing situation, A's Astros. Laureano got suspended, we found out, just within the last hour or so. 4 games. The Oakland A's outfielder who led to the bases clearing and benches clearing brawl. No problem with his 4-game suspension. It's very clear you're not allowed to fight this year. Baseball's made that known, and then he charged the dugout, which was silly. So suspend him 4 games. What I cared most about was Cintron, and I wanted him to get suspended massively, and he did. 20 games is a big deal, particularly in a 60-game season. I thought they threw the book at him and the kitchen sink at him, and they should have. So good for baseball, 20 games for the coach, 4 games for the player. I'm in on that.
Same here. At least somebody from the Astros is getting suspended. It's not one of the fall guys that they picked.
Not one of the guys that was cheating years ago, right. but at least someone in that uniform is having to get suspended for something.
Joe Kelly did his teammate Ross Stripling's podcast and went super hard with the Astros. And as much of a goof as I think Joe Kelly is, I'm sitting there standing and clapping, doing like an "Oh, Captain, my Captain" bit. I was all in on that guy. Go check out what he said for yourself. But it's basically, I don't respect these guys. They ratted out, blamed a couple other people, and kept those paychecks coming. Major League Baseball is super, super culpable. But the way the Astros themselves handled this, oh, so annoying. So it's good that somebody finally got something.
Yeah, and Kelly basically said, "I'll be mad forever." He's like, "I think I'm just going to be mad forever about it." He's like, "Nothing happened. and they basically told the world that other teams are doing it too and tried to throw other people under the bus. He's like, I just, no respect. But yeah, it is absolutely worth your time. You want to look it up. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks a ton for listening. If you missed any part of our show, go to thefandc.com or you can rewind the radio.com app. For Sean and Thom and Danny, I'm Grant, saying so long.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.